Hi, I'm Sue. I'm a very grateful member of the Al-Anon family group because today I live an alcoholic, and that feels good to say that. I want to thank the committee for inviting Keith and I to be here, and I want to thank all of you for the love and support by coming here, and I want to especially thank our friends that we've known for years that have traveled a ways to be here, and it's neat to see Tom here. We need people like Tom in our lives. I was sharing at my home group the other night, and the emphasis was on newcomers, how important the newcomers are in our lives. Yeah, and the final sharing in that meeting was that it's just as important to recognize the old-timers in this program as it is the newcomers, because we can't make it without either one of them. Yeah, and so I'm grateful that I have old-timers in my life. I love newcomers. I love newcomer stories. I used to think that jokes that I heard, people made them up, until I started going to open AA speaker meetings with my husband and found out that they were true stories. That all those things drunks really do. And I've been in this program long enough to see the humor of the newcomer, of the Al-Anon newcomers, and I love Al-Anon newcomers. Yeah, one newcomer one time said that, her husband had left. She was afraid he was never going to come back, and she was worried about him and all that kind of stuff. And another newcomer raised her hand and said, "Honey, don't worry about it. They always come back. They're like boomerangs." She said, "Happiness to me would be opening the refrigerator door and seeing his face on a milk carton." Yeah, well, back I was sharing in a meeting in Los Angeles, and this newcomer came up to me and she said, "You know, my husband's been sober in AA for 2 years, and we're going to family counseling, and my counselor told me that I had to come to Al-Anon, that all the problems that we're having are my fault." She said, "We have knockdown, drag-out fights all the time." And I said, "Well, I had to look at myself after I got here. I was told to keep my eyes on myself, keep my mouth shut, and stay out of his face." She said, "I'm not doing any of that." And I said, "Well, I never got in an argument or a fight with a drunk unless I was standing in his face." And she said, "No, it's not me, it's him." So I said, "Okay." So after the meeting, she came up to me and she'd gone and gotten her husband. There was an AA meeting next door. And she said, "I'd like to introduce my husband to you." And I said, "Okay." So I stuck my hand out to shake his hand, and she lifted up his hand and stuck his hand out and put it in mine. And I looked at her kind of funny, and she said, "He's blind." I said, "Jesus Christ, he's got to find you before he can hit you." But she wasn't in his face. I love it, yeah. Denial ain't a river in Egypt. It was great. Anyway, it's by the grace of God that I get to stand here today. And I know that. And I'm grateful for my past, because, you see, I didn't have alcoholism in my family. They were so-called a normal family. But I believe that my God loved me so much, and I was so off beam in my search for a power greater than myself, that my God put an alcoholic in my life so I could find my God. And I really believe that today. It's, the find is in the search. And I had to do a lot of things to come to you and to find you. And I believe that God put you in my life because you introduced me to a power greater than myself. And my God used people to get me here. It's so neat. I came into the program the same time Keith did. Next month we'll have 19 years in this program. And I always wanted to be an old-timer, and I still want to be an old-timer. I want to be all the things that the old-timers were when I was new and still are to me today. And I don't have those feelings about me today. I still feel like I'm a newcomer. I like to hang out with people that let me see me, that lets me feel like a newcomer, that I get to, I don't know everything, and there's so much to learn. And I like that feeling, because if I ever think that I know it all, then I'll probably be out of here, because I came in here a real know-it-all. And I got to go to the Southern California Al-Anon Convention last weekend, and I got to see some of my peers that I grew up with in this program. And they were talking to me about having 20 years in Al-Anon, and last year standing around and the breeze was blowing beside them and there was nobody there. That scared the hell out of them, and they made a new commitment to this program. And they're back involved in being on convention committees and being secretary in their home group. And this one girl said, you know, you understand. And I said, no, I don't. Thank God I don't understand that. Because if I quit doing what I'm doing, then I know that I'm the person that will go back to the way it was before I got here. And I don't ever want to do that again. This morning in the morning meditation, it talks about our past being our greatest asset. We look about it, we write about it, do inventories about it, and then we move on because this program gives us the answer. And I don't have to live in those problems anymore, but I sure can't forget them either. Now, Keith was mentioned earlier about the movie that we went to, and Jesus, I sat in that movie, and that lady in that movie was me. The drunk walked up behind her and hit her in the back with a piece of wood, and she sat down and collected herself and tolerated the pain, and he went in and sat in his chair and started drinking while she finished dinner. And just out of the quietness, out of the blue, while he was sitting there just very calmly enjoying a can of Coke that had booze in it, he got a bowl upside the head. And he's sitting there and blood's running down the side of his head. And she comes and stands in front of him with an axe. And he tells her, you know, if you do that, I'm going to kill your ass. And she lays the axe in his lap and says, do it. My God, that was me. You know, I never knew how to stay out of a drunk's face. And as I progressed in my own insanity and I met the alcoholic in my life, you know, we had a lot of fun at first. It was a lot of fun. He was doing the things that just turned me on. Boy, the minute I met an alcoholic, my life started. It's like I was downtown in the fast lane right now. And he was doing stuff and making it happen, and it's just like he got me there. And I'm sure that the alcoholics in this room relate to alcohol in the same way that I relate to the alcoholic. My friend Arbita says, the only difference between an alcoholic and an Al-Anon is the obsession. His is the booze and mine's the boozer. And boy, that's the way it was with me. And I met Keith at a country dance, and it started out from there. After that, he called me and said that he wanted to go out, and I said, okay. And my mom said, no. You're not going to go with him. He's older than you. He's been married before, and he's in trouble all the time. And I said, I don't care. Because, you see, I'd just gotten home from being in an unwed mother's home, and the first thing he said to me, looked me right square in the eye, and he said, honey, we deserve each other. And we did. And we still do. And the reason I say we still do is because I don't think he loves anything more than he loves Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't think of anything I love more than I love this program and this way of life and a God of my own understanding. And because of that, we love each other. It's a byproduct of working this program. It's to get to fall in love with the man that you used to hate. And I knew there was always something there. You know, us Al-Anons think, we don't quit. We're not quitters. We never give up. We don't know how to give up. And it's like, not giving up almost killed me. Not giving up almost killed him. Because Keith and I were both violent, and we used weapons when we fought. Keith being a cowboy, he always had a gun, and he used to shoot that gun. It'd shoot things you didn't want to shoot, and you never could tell when it was going to go off. And it scared the heck out of me. And so I picked up a 12-inch butcher knife, and I started fighting back with a butcher knife. You see, I can't blame the man in my life for all the violence that went on in our home, because there was so many times I'd be right in his face with a finger and he'd say, Sue, get out of my face. And I'd take one step closer and he'd say, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you. And I'd take one step closer and he'd hit me, and the knockdown, drag-out fight would be on. And then when I wouldn't quit, he'd pick up the gun and I'd pick up the knife. And we'd be right in each other's face. There's times he'd stick that gun right on the end of my nose, and he'd say, if you don't shut up, I'm going to shoot you. And I'd say, you go first, and I'd stick my knife right in his stomach. He'd say, what do you mean? If I shoot you, you're dead. And I said, I know, but when the bullet hits me, it'll knock me backwards. The momentum will make the knife go forwards. And I said, we'll both die at the same time, so go for it. And he'd look at me, and he'd say, you're crazy. And I was. And so the other night when I was watching that movie, I identified with that lady that stuck that hatchet in his lap and said, go for it. Because you see, when I got here, when I did my inventory, I did a fear list. And I remember the first thing I put on that fear list, and the only thing at first, and I called my sponsor. And I said, you know what my fear is? It's the only one I can think of. I don't have any fear. I was afraid because I didn't know how to be afraid. And she said, you got to write about it. You got to ask God to help you to look at that. Because there can't be somebody as angry as you are without some kind of fear in your life. And so I said, God, you got to help me, and it's got to be pretty simple because I'm not that smart. And when I started writing about fear, the first thing I thought of, okay, fear of the dark. And I started writing about fear of the dark, and it started coming to me that when I was a little kid, I grew up in the Texas Panhandle, and when it's dark there, it's dark, dark. And we get through with dinner, and after dinner, the trash had to be taken out. And my mom had asked my sister, who's 4 years older than I was, to take out the trash. And my sister say, no, I'm not going to go out there. It's dark, and I'm afraid of the dark. And my mother would say, well, Sue will take it out. She's not afraid of anything. I'd say, yeah, I'll take out the trash. And I'd get on that back porch, and I'd shut the door, and I'd have that trash, and I'd run lickety-split back there to the alley to the trash can, and I'd dump that trash, and I'd take out, running right back the back door, and I'd stand there on the back door and go, catching my breath before I walked in, because I couldn't let anybody know I was afraid. And I'd walk in that house so smug and arrogant and say, no big deal. I'm not afraid of nothing. And as I was writing, I thought, what was I afraid of out there? What was I afraid of? And I thought, I don't know. And it came to me, that's it. That's it. I'm afraid of the unknown. Because in the disease of alcoholism, you never know what's next. So you have nothing to look forward to because you know the disease is going to make it bad. And so you're afraid of everything. I was afraid of everything and thought I was afraid of nothing. And the good news is that this program has taught me that if I have the fear of the unknown and I have a God in my life and I love that God and I have faith in that God, I can have faith in the unknown. because there hasn't been a time since I've been in this program that God hasn't given me something good. Every time He has given me the courage to walk through that wall of fear, there's been something good waiting for me on the other side. And my God's been real good to me. And going in through the insanity, and Keith and I dated for 2 years, fought, fell in sick. He got a draft notice. We couldn't live without each other. So we ran off and got married. And shortly after that, we had Simone, our daughter. And I was so naive about alcoholism, and I remember when they handed her to me thinking, thank God she's a girl. Because Keith was a drunk, his dad was a drunk, and his granddad was a town drunk, and if we'd had a boy, he would have carried on the family tradition, he would have been a drunk. You see, I didn't know that the disease of alcoholism doesn't care what sex, color, race, or creed you are. It takes you into the gates of insanity and hell, and you don't even have to drink booze to get there. Because alcoholism is a progressive disease, and all you have to do to get it is to live with it. You have to drink alcohol to become an alcoholic. But you just have to live with the disease to become affected with the insanity. And living with that insanity does not make me an Al-Anon. I had to hit a bottom, and I had to surrender to a new way of life. I had to start going to Al-Anon meetings. I had to get a sponsor, and I had to work the steps, and I have to give it away. And that's what makes me an Al-Anon, not being married to an alcoholic. See, Keith was a drunk before he got to AA. I was just sick before I got to Al-Anon. And so I've had to make a new total surrender in my head of what's the best way to think. And they told me when I was new that I had to give up all my old ideas. I had to give up the ideas that I can manage and control and do everything. And it was that managing and controlling that made me insane, because I always knew that if I could just make him do it this way, that it'd be okay. And we'd have those fights, and I'd call the cops, or Simone would call the cops, and they'd come and arrest Keith, or the neighbors would call the cops, and the cops were at our house all the time. Sometimes they came for me, because I tried to beat the cop up with a holster, a gun holster, and he thought I'd hid the gun. Keith had the gun, and he didn't understand that the holster was my weapon that night. And then I'd have to go around the next day and bail him out with a hot check. I didn't know that that was insane. And see, I blamed it all on him. But I'm the one that has hot checks out all over Orange County, not him. I remember one time we was kiting checks all over everywhere, and they were bouncing from one bank to another, and one bank called me and told me I was in big time trouble. And I called the other bank and I asked for the president of that bank. And I told him, it says that our account's depleted, it doesn't have anything in it, what are you doing to us? And I'm screaming at him on the phone. He said, well, let me pull it up in the computer. And for some reason that day, their computers were down, and he couldn't pull it up. And I said, we even have a loan at your bank. You can't tell me I don't have a checking account. I said, now you're going to call these other two banks, and you're going to tell them that you made a mistake and it was wrong, and you're going to make it right. And he said, but that's not our policy. And I said, not till today. And he said, and what if I don't do that? I said, then I'm going to walk in there and punch you out. And I told him I'd give him 30 minutes. I bet he was looking for a 6'5" woman as big as the door walking in there in his office. And 30 minutes later, the other bank called me and said, you know, we're sorry, the bank called us and they'd made a mistake. I wasn't afraid of those kind of things. I wasn't afraid that we wrote two different checks to pay the IRS our back taxes. I put our Social Security on one check, but I didn't put it on the other, so the IRS came after us. Gonna garnish my wages. And I go down to the IRS, and I'm raising hell with them because I sent two checks and I covered those taxes. And this lady at the IRS looked at me and she said, "Did you put your Social Security number on both checks?" And I said, "No, just on the top one. I have copies of them." And I said, "But I stapled them together." And she said, "You should have put it on both checks." She goes, "That's stupid." I went crazy. Because the disease of alcoholism was always telling me that I was dumb, that I was stupid, that I was a nobody, and my disease started believing it. And then I get in a place like that, and a lady tells me I'm stupid, I just went nuts. And I said, "Get her away from me. Get her out of here. Nobody talks to me like that." There was a hippie in there that was there under three or four aliases, and they were trying to figure out what his name was, and he was going, "Right on, lady, get him, go for it." And the more he said it, the more I did it. And they finally asked me to leave, that they'd straighten it out themselves. My disease spread all over everywhere. When it says in the 12th step we practice these principles in all of our affairs in the 12th tradition, that's the kind of stuff they're talking about. How our disease goes out into the community, into every place. Because I never knew how to act. When we finally moved to California, we went from Texas to California, and we were used to hanging out in the honky-tonks and drinking out of paper sacks and having the fights all the time. And then Keith said, "You know, if you go to California with me, you'll be a lady because you can walk in a restaurant and you can order cocktails. You'll never have to drink out of a paper sack again." Wow, I was ready to go. And we get out there, and he finally came home one night and said, "You want to go to dinner?" And I said, "Yes." And so we get all dressed up and cleaned up, and we go to this beautiful brick building, and it has cocktails on neon lights on the front of it. It doesn't have rosies painted above the door or Shangri-La on a board. And it's like, yes, I'm a lady. I've arrived. And God, I wanted to be a lady. I didn't know how to act like a lady, and I wanted to be a lady more than anything. And we walk in that restaurant, and they seat us. And they come over and they ask us if we want a cocktail, and I said, "You bet." And we ordered Simona Shirley Temple. We didn't leave her out of our disease at all. And they bring them over and they set them down in front of us, and Keith picks up his drink and he said, "I want a toast to the good life, babe." And we're sitting there, we toast to the good life. And it was wonderful. And I didn't think you could get drunk in those places drinking cocktails, but I didn't know he could drink 10 to my one and they'd do it every time he asked for it. But I knew exactly how many he drank. I counted every one of them. And I watched those people in that room, and they were drinking out of these long-stemmed crystal glasses and swishing this stuff, and I'd never seen anything like that before because I grew up in the oil fields and lived in a trailer house. Moved all over, called white trash all my life. So I never had stuff like that. And I was impressed. And I wanted to be that way. And you see, I was always judging your outsides with my insides. If I could just feel the way you looked, I'd be okay. And so that's what I wanted. Because if I had that or I did that, I'd be okay. I'd be a lady. And so they came over and took our order and said, "Would you like wine with your dinner?" And I said, "You bet." And they brought it over and set down those crystal glasses, and it's like, oh, wow. And then they did a real dumb thing. They poured Keith just a little bit and asked him to taste it to see if it was okay. And I looked at that waiter and I said, what do you mean, is it okay? He drank stuff in Oklahoma and had things floating in it. Pour mine. And they poured mine, and I sat there in all my smug and arrogance, and I swished it, and I sniffed it, and I didn't know what in the heck I was doing all that for, but I wanted to be a lady. And God, I felt so good. Until I look across the table at Keith, and he's drinking out of the carafe. And I just yell at him, what are you doing? And he yells back at me, I'm drinking. What's it look like I'm doing? And I go, now look, everybody's looking at us. And he looks over at him, what are you looking at? And I go, now they are looking at us. And Simone slides under the table and goes, not here. And I holler at the waiter and I said, bring us our food. And he comes over and he said, no, you're not eating here. And I said, why not? He said, because you don't know how to act. Oh my God. It wasn't Keith, it was me. And the feelings that I went through walking out of there, we can't ever come back because Keith's talking to everybody in sign language on the way out. It's like we could never go anywhere. That's what the disease of alcoholism does to us. We don't know. We have no principles. We have no morals before we get here. That's why it says, we practice these principles in all of our affairs. I had to learn what the principles were. I had none. And I had to keep coming to you, and I had to keep doing the things that I did in order to find out what you were doing. And I had to go as far as I had to go. And I don't ever like to forget to share what the last drunk in our home was like, because I don't ever want to forget it. Because you see, all the times that we'd had those fights, we didn't leave Simone out. We'd have those fights and I'd be in that blind rage and Keith would walk away from me, and you don't walk away from me. And I'd turn around and I'd be full of that rage and anger, and Simone would be standing there and I'd take the rest of it out on her. She hated me just as much, if not more, than she hated the alcoholic, because you see, Daddy's drunk. But what's wrong with Mama? She doesn't drink and she goes crazy. And that night in our home, you know, I had thought so many times that I could fix the alcoholic, that if I run away, and we did that all the time, we'd go stay in a motel for the weekend, or we'd lock Keith out or throw his stuff out, and we did it all just like you did. And I hope that if you're sitting in here today, that you know that you did it all. Whatever it is that gets you here and keeps you here. Because there's no doubt in my mind today that we did it all. And the hopes and the dreams, they were busted. And the kind of well-meaning people that always tells us, you know, why don't you leave? Why don't you get out? Lawyers say leave. A lawyer told me one time, if you love him, take him to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I went in there and I was all beat up. And he said, do you fight like this all the time? And I said, no, only when he drinks. He said, you think he's an alcoholic? And I said, I don't know what one is. And he said, it's somebody who can't stop drinking. I said, then he must be one. I poured booze out. I filled it up with water. I've done everything. He said, if you love him, take him to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went home that night and I looked at Keith and I said, I went to a lawyer again today, but he told me this time, if I love you, to take you to Alcoholics Anonymous. He looked at me so sincere and he said, babe, I thought I'd come to this. So I called a man in AA today. And he told me where there's a meeting tonight, just right down the street. I said, what time does it start? He said, 8:30. And I said, okay, we'll go. And he said, we'll see. I didn't know he was on a court card. I wanted to think if he loved me enough, he'd quit drinking. I wanted to think it was me, that I could fix it, that I could change it. And I hurried and fixed dinner, because if you're going to take him someplace like that, you got to cook for him first. And then Simone and I did the dishes, and I kept watching the clock. And at 8 o'clock, I went over and I got my butcher knife, and I walked over at the sofa, and I said, "Get up." He goes, "What for?" And I said, "We're going to go to that AA meeting." He said, "I don't think so." And I said, "I think you are." And I jabbed him again. And he went out and got in the car with me, and we got over there at that church. I said, "What time's this meeting over?" He said, 10:30. I said, "I'll tell you something, dude. You come out of that door for 10:30, I'll gut you." Now, when I got to Al-Anon, you told me I couldn't keep a drunk sober. But I did for 4 months, sitting in that parking lot with my butcher knife every Monday night. And the thing about that that I think is so important is that that didn't keep him sober. It is so important for me to know everything that I can learn about the disease of alcoholism. And when I was new here, I was told to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the Al-Anon literature says to learn everything you can. And what a better place to learn about it than the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you see, I had to learn that I had to do everything that I had to do. And Keith drank for another 4 years, and the insanity doubled, tripled in that period of time, and I got crazier. And the insanity was worse on Simone during that period of time. Many times she was comforting me instead of the mother comforting the child. And I see that so many times. So at that last drunk, I don't want to forget any of that stuff. I don't want to forget who I was and where it took me and the things that I can do and the things that I can't do. And Keith had Simone over in the corner doing the things to her he'd always did, but it's like I saw it for the first time. And I looked at Keith, and I didn't pick up my knife, and I didn't scream and holler and yell. And very calmly, a calmness came over me. And I looked at him, and I said, "Keith, I don't love you anymore. But I don't hate you either. And if you got to become a Skid Row bum, because that's what I thought happened to drunks, then that's what you got to do. But Simone and I ain't going to go with you anymore." And her and I got a few things together, and we walked out of that house for the last time. I believe that's the point that I hit a bottom. And I believe that every Al-Anon has to hit a bottom just like every alcoholic does. And we were gone for about 4 days. I don't know what happened in those 4 days. I think Al-Anons function in whiteouts. And Simone had to have some things for school, and so she begged me to take her back home, and we went back by the house, and we went in there, and we were afraid of what we'd find, because Keith was always shooting pets and all kinds of stuff in that house, and he was going to commit suicide a number of times. So we walked in there, and we looked around, and we finally got the bedroom, and Keith was face down on the bedroom floor. We thought he was dead, so we kicked him. And he turned over and he looked at me and he said, "Sue, please help." And I know that's when I took the first step. I know that's when God came into my life and he put one word in my mouth that I could never say to that drunk before. One word is so hard for us. I said, "No. No, I can't help you. If you want help, you help yourself." And thank God the seed had been planted. And he went to the phone and made some phone calls. And we had to fight with a gun and knife one more time. And then the doorbell rang, and I answered the door, and there's a little gray-headed, shriveled-up man standing there, and I'm thinking, "Geez, why don't they send the big ones on these trips?" And I watched the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happen in our home. And I am so grateful to little Jack. He's still in our life today. And he did exactly what it talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. he 12-stepped the family up. He asked me to go with him to take Keith to a detox, and I did. And then he took me back home, and he sat in the driveway with me, and he told me some very valuable information. He said, "Sue, you need to go to Al-Anon." And I said, "No, I don't. Thank you very much. If he'll quit drinking, I'll be fine." He said, "I want to tell you something." He said, "I've seen it happen many times, and today I can say I've seen it happen many times. That a sober alcoholic can't go home to an old idea and stay sober. He'll either have to drink again or he'll have to leave to maintain his sobriety. And I've seen it happen many times." And he went in the house and he told Simone that if she loved her daddy, the only way she could help him was go to a program called Alateen. And so Simone and I started going to one meeting a week. Keith came home, started going to a meeting every day. He needed it. He was sicker than us. And after about 6 weeks, he wasn't doing it my way. He's sober now. He can't be treating us this way. He's supposed to be home. The meeting's over at 10. He should be in the door by 10:15, 10:30 latest. He's still not minding. And I start going crazy. He can't treat us this way. I just went nuts. And I went in the bathroom. I thought I'd take a warm bath and relax, and I sit in there. And going to one meeting a week for 6 months, one of my best ideas came into my mind. I could kill him now, and he'd have pallbearers. That's how well I was getting on one meeting a week. And he came home and my mouth was attached to the doorknob just like it had always been. "You aren't going to treat us this way again." And he said the most devastating thing he'd ever said to me. He said, "Sue, get out of my face." And I took one step closer and he looked at me and he said, "Sue, I ain't going to hit you no more." He said, "I can't hit you and stay sober. My sobriety comes first. You're going to have to fix yourself." Whoa. I took off running for the bathroom, and I was crazy, and I slammed the door, and as I whirled around, I saw a crazy person in that mirror. And I know it sounds stupid, but this is the way my God gets my attention. As the words came to me, is that one meeting a week is not going to fix you. And today I know that on two meetings a week I can uncomfortably maintain, and on three or more meetings a week I can grow. And I found out early on that impatience and greed were my two character defects that I hated the most. The more meetings I go to, the more I get. I don't have to wait that long on recovery. It comes faster the more meetings I sit in. And I started going to those meetings for me. And I am so grateful that I got to find a program called Al-Anon. When I walked in, the Al-Anon Big Book at that time, its cover said, "Living with an Alcoholic," and I knew you knew. And I sat in those meetings, and people were talking about sponsors, and there was this lady in the meeting that she answered all my questions before I ever asked, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And she started me on a path. She gave me a foundation that I will forever be grateful for. People loved me and tolerated me, and I was so hateful and arrogant when I got here. And people were coming up, you were hugging on me. God, you were hugging on me, and I hated it. Nobody had ever been nice to me before unless they wanted something. And I went up to her one night and I said, "What are they hugging me for? Why did they have to touch me?" And she said, "Because they just want you to keep coming back." And I said, "Then why in the hell don't they just say that?" And she looked at me and she said, "I'm going to tell you something, smart mouth." She said, "When you put your arms around them and they put their arms around you, God's follows, and you're both embraced in the fellowship of this program, and you're safe." She said, you will start collecting 8 hugs at every meeting you go to. And I said, I don't want to. And she said, I don't care. And every time I'd tell her something that I didn't want to do, she'd say, I don't care. She'd make me do that. And I started collecting those hugs, and I started feeling good. And I told her one night, I'm feeling good about this now. I love it. I love coming to these meetings, but I don't feel this way at home. She said, I want to tell you something. We don't care how wonderful you are for an hour and a half. If you're not taking this program home, you don't have one. She said, now tonight you're going to go home and you're going to hug Keith. And I said, I don't want to. She said, I don't care. And so I went home that night and I waited for Keith to come home to his meeting. And here he came. And I'm going, oh, whoa. And I start down the hallway and he starts walking down the hallway toward me. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, God. And he gets up beside me and I put my arm around him and I hug him. He goes, what's that for? And I said, just for the hell of it. They told me to do it. Don't ask me why. And my sponsor always told me I didn't have to like what I was told to do here. I just had to do it. And that's how we started bringing the love in our home. My sponsor told me that the woman sets the pace in the house. And that it was no different than 12-step work, that I treated my family just like I treated newcomers. And that I would get back what I gave away in that home. If I was constantly bitching, moaning, and complaining, that's what I was going to get back. But if I started giving away love and compliments, then that's what I'd start giving back. And I started giving Keith compliments all the time, and I called her up. He hadn't said one thing nice about me yet. She said, you didn't get sick overnight. You're not going to get well overnight in that home. She said, you just keep doing what you're doing. And that man tells me, I love you. He gives me compliments. He told me this morning that I look pretty. I don't have to ask anymore. And you told me if I cleaned up and showed up, that God would work from within. And that there would be a day that I felt like a lady. And I was told that I had to look in that mirror every morning and say, good morning, Sue, I love you. And it was tough. But there's a lady in that mirror every morning now looking back at me that loves me. You gave me that. You gave me the self-worth and helped me find it. And the self-esteem that I look for forever. You gave me the feelings of being a lady, a total, complete, fulfilled woman. I never wanted to be a woman. I resented being a woman because we got to do things guys don't have to do. And it's a hassle most of the time. And I got to understand that God made me special. I used to tell Elsa Chamberlain, I want to be just like you when I grow up. She was in her 80s. She had 40-some years in this program. She used to get so mad at me when I'd tell her that. She'd say, you got to be just like you when you grow up. Not me. She said, God only made one of me. If he had made two of me, one of us would have been unnecessary. And she said, you're special. There's only one of you. You fulfill your God, your commitment to your God and to this program, and there'll be a day when you feel special. And I have those feelings today, and they're not feelings of arrogance. I felt special last weekend at that convention where some of my peers were, that they started walking away from the program or had walked away from the program and made a new commitment. I made a commitment almost 19 years ago to my God that I don't want to live this way anymore. And I was told that you will be given direction and all you have to do is follow that direction. And thank God I've had strong sponsorship in my life. I've never stopped taking that direction. And today, because I did that, I walked around that convention last weekend feeling good that I have what I have today in my job, in the community, in my home, and in this program with you. I don't have to walk around making amends to anybody. And it's not a feeling of arrogance. It's a warm feeling inside that, yeah, God, I'm on your side, and I know you're on mine. God, it felt good. And as a result of that, a lady walked up to me and made amends to me of a 9-year-old resentment she'd had. Didn't say what it was. She just said, I love you. And I said, thank you for speaking to me after 9 years. I didn't know what I'd done. And she said, you didn't do anything. And one of my friends was standing there and she said, that's incredible. What a program, Sue. You've waited 9 years for this. Because it was a lady I loved a lot. 9 years. I'm willing to do what I have to do in order to make it right with my God and my fellow man. I'm willing to wait for the good stuff. I'm willing to do what I have to do. There's a speaker in AA that says some of us are here to give resentments and some of us are here to take them. And I guess sometimes I'm the giver most of the time. And what I've recognized of that is some people resent me because I'm not willing to prostitute my program or my life in any way, shape, or form. I'm very strong and I'm very hard-nosed about the things that I have to do in my life in order to stay here. I won't compromise. I did that for years. And it got me sick as all get out. I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to go back from the way where I came from. I don't want to go back to insanity. I want to keep doing the things that I've done. I want to keep doing more. I want more. There's more waiting on me. Enough's never enough. And I want it all. I want it all. So I'm not going to forget the old-timers, and I'm not going to quit paying attention to the newcomers. And as a result of that, I get to have fun in my life. It's a byproduct of this program. It is not the program to have fun. It is a byproduct of this program. And a lot of people think that, oh, we get here and we have fun. I get to have fun because of work of program. I don't get to go to the program to have fun. And a result of that, I love an alcoholic today. I love him so much. And I was taught, like he said in the very beginning, when he used to drive me crazy, just look at him and say, ain't he cute? And he is. He's funny. I had to learn to understand his sense of humor. And when he said how he says, I love you. This morning when I got up, I was getting ready, and I put one of my contacts in, and it didn't feel right, and I took it out, and it tore in half. And half of it was on my finger, and half of it was in my eye. And I asked Keith, I said, can you put on your glasses and help me? I still have half a contact in my eye. He said, well, I don't know how to do that. He said, I could hit you in the back of the head and make it pop out. I just laughed. It's like, ain't he cute? He didn't. He said, Sue, I don't know how to do these kind of things. Yeah, and it came out. But it's like only an alcoholic would think stuff like that when you think that you're in the middle of a crisis, you know? Oh, my God, my eye. Yeah, well, let's hit you. Whoop. God, I love it. Nobody thinks like alcoholics think. They're quick. They're humorous. If you're not enjoying the alcoholic in your life, look at yourself and see what you're not doing. I was taught to give it the light touch. There is something always humorous in what we're doing. My God has a sense of humor. I just love Him so much. And He lets me go to places and do things, you know. 6 years ago, I got involved in H&I work. And Tom was very instrumental in planting that seed. And I get to go in women's prisons. And we've been in the women's prison out in Chino, California for almost 6 years now. And it's really neat. And we went in there last Wednesday night. God, the growth that I've gotten. I don't know what some of those women are getting. I have an idea. But what they've given me is so much. And you know why I love going in there so much? Because they don't care. Most of them don't care. A lot of them do. And a lot of them are growing. But they give me so much. There's no ego in H&I service. You just do it for fun and for free because you never know who's going to get it. But what I got last Wednesday night was awesome to me. We take our literature, our hardback books in there, and we give them away. And we had 5 books this last Wednesday to give away. And the way we give them away, we can't give them to individuals. And they sign in. And so we ask how many inmates are in the meeting, and then we call numbers at random out, and whoever signed in under that number gets the book. And so we'd given... I walked in with these books, and... The company I work for distributes paper goods. And one of the companies we distribute paper goods for is Saks Fifth Avenue. We have their sacks and their tissue paper and their bags. And we have a sample room, and you can just, you know, use stuff out of there. And so they had this little bag with handles on it, and these 5 books just fit perfect in that bag. And so I'd used one of those Saks Fifth Avenue bags to carry those books into that prison with. And I didn't even think. Tom, no. And we're standing there, and we're sitting out our literature on the table, and these girls are eyeballing that Saks Fifth Avenue bag. And I said, I looked at it, and I said, don't worry, I don't shop there. And they all laughed. And I told them that how I got the bag, and they said, forget the books, we want the bag. Now, 5 years ago, when we started taking those books in there, we called those numbers out, those books were priceless and precious to those women, and they still are. But those women were so selfish and self-centered, and it was mine, my book. And if we called a number and a girl got another book, like she'd gotten her second book, the inmates would holler, you already got one. And she'd say something like, screw you, it's mine. It was my number, it's my book. And so this last Wednesday night, we gave those books away. And I thought, what the heck? So I called a number. I said, number 25, I'm giving the bag away. And this Barbara, a long-timer, she's a lifer, and she's a long-time member of the program sitting on the front row. She's a lifer. And she jumps up, and she said, oh, yay! That's my number. I get the bag. Oh, wow. And the secretary over there that keeps track of the numbers says, no, Barbara, you're 26. You don't get the bag. And Barbara goes, oh, no. And her lip goes out. She sits down and she starts pouting. And this little Mexican gal from the back of the room stands up. They called her name. She's number 25. And she comes up and she takes the bag. I give it to her and I give her a hug. And she turns around and she walks over to Barbara and gives her the bag. Six years of recovery gave those inmates that kind of an attitude. Keith has a panel in there once a month with AAs. And I have an Al-Anon panel in there. And I get to be H&I coordinator for Southern California in World Service. And I am so grateful for that commitment. And it's so neat because really all my job is to try to generate enthusiasm, to get people to go into the facilities, different kinds of facilities, and keep a commitment. And that's one of the hardest things there is for people, they want to say, oh, I did that, and then they're done, because the ego's in there. And the hardest thing it is say, I will do that, and know what a commitment really means. And I was taught in the very beginning what a commitment really means. And a commitment means that I have showed up the first Wednesday of every month in that prison for 6 years and never missed that meeting. What that has done is put a lot of trust in there. A lot of trust. Those inmates trust me today. And I love them so much. And I got a phone call a couple of weeks ago, and it was from a man in Sacramento. He's with the State of California Department of Corrections. And he asked me if I would serve on an advisory panel representing Al-Anon to set up guidelines for programs in prisons. As a volunteer representing Al-Anon. So you see, if I just keep doing what I'm doing, the commitments come. And what it does when I get those commitments is a new form of enthusiasm for this program and my God coming to my life. That's, yeah, God, I wanna. The name of my home group's Gotta Wanna. And they named it that because you gotta want it to be in our group, because we don't have half measures, in our opinion. A rumor went around Orange County here a while back that we were a cult and that we were charging $10 for newcomers to attend our meetings, which is not true. But an old timer in L.A. called me and left a message on my recorder. She said, "Sue, I heard you're charging $15 in Orange County for newcomers to attend your meetings." And she said, "Send them to L.A. We got a discount going on and we're only charging $12.50. And I called her back and left a message on her recorder. We don't do that to newcomers, but we got a senior citizens discount going if you're interested. And we just kind of have fun batting stuff back and forth like that. But I was asked what we did about that rumor going around about our group last weekend at the convention. What did you do about that rumor? I said nothing. This lady said, nothing. Why? I said, because when you're working a program and you're doing it right, there's nothing to defend. We have nothing to defend if we're applying the principles of this program to our life. Just like Keith said, Simone's doing it in Italy. And we're doing it in our home group. And we're doing it here with you. Wherever God wants me, that's where I do it. Because you see, God gave me a second chance at this life. I don't know how to tell my God no. I don't know how to say, no, I don't want this anymore. I'd rather do it my way. You see, that attitude got me here. I don't want to do it that way anymore. I want to love the alcoholic in my life. And he loves me. He's so supportive of my program, that's how I know he loves me. Simone loves me. God, we have a tremendous relationship going. She calls us about every 6 weeks or once a month to let us know that she loves us. And just to talk about the latest that's going on in her life. And this last month, she's all excited because she started a preteen meeting. And she said, those kids are so funny. She said, Mom, I know I'm supposed to help keep order in those meetings, but she said, I laugh with them. She said, they remind me so much of me when I was new. And she said, they're so cute, and their folks think they're such brats. And she said, but I just love on them. You know, it's just like one of the inmates said to me one night. She said, Sue, I don't know why I'm in here and you're not. You're meaner than me. And I said, I don't either. But I guess we both get to carry the message no matter where we're at, and he's relying on us both. You get to do it in here, and I just get to do it out there is the only difference. The place we stay doesn't mean a thing. What's in our hearts does. This program is the language of the heart. Celebrate the miracle as recovery. Every one of us in this program that wants this thing can turn our life around and we become a miracle ourselves. And the grace of God works in our lives. And He works through us. It's up to us to give it away. And I want to give it away because somebody gave it to me. And I like to close with a story that I heard from a lady in this room. It's a story about a little boy that's laying in his bed one night, and it's thundering and lightning outside. And he gets scared, and he runs and jumps in bed and gets in bed with his dad. And he's laying there shivering, and his dad said, cuddles him up, and he goes, son, what's wrong with you? He said, I'm afraid, Daddy. He said, I was afraid it's thundering and lightning in there, and I was by myself and afraid. And his daddy cuddles him up more, and he said, son, you don't have to be afraid. You weren't in there alone. God was in there with you. He said, yeah, I know, Daddy, but right now I need something with skin on it. And that's what you are to me. You're my skin on it. I want to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous and to Alateen and to Al-Anon for putting a family back together, to helping us become lovers, to helping us know that we know nothing. But then once you get to the 11th step, it says you know. And today there are some things I know. I know there's a God in my life, and I know that you're in my life no matter what. I don't have to walk around with the facades and the phoniness and the lies. I don't have to do all those things anymore and the smug and arrogance and the know-it-all attitude. Because you gave this thing to me for fun and for free. I thought I had it all together when I got here. But I know that today we've got it all. Thank you very much.